Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, August 30th, 2013. Just going to have ourselves a little weekend war.
Absolutely.
A limited strike to spank Bashar al-Assad. No boots on the ground. No lingering commitments. Just kind of a drive-by, fly-by shooting. And to express our absolute rejection of the evils of killing innocents with chemical weapons, we will launch assaults that will likely kill innocents with high-tech Tomahawk cruise missiles. The stock of Raytheon is shot up in anticipation of clearing the inventory, at least part of it, at the Pentagon. And I am stunned by the contrast between public opinion, which does not support this in the United States or in Britain, and the continuing posture of the United States leadership. Today, President Obama gave a brief interview with cameras clicking away in the cabinet room. He's framed by all kinds of flags, wrapped in them, frankly. And he's reassuring us that this is not going to be another Iraq. No boots on the ground, no long-term commitment. But that we have no choice, in his view, but to act, to send a message, teach a lesson to the brutal dictator, the guy who we say runs a regime, not a government. Oh, it was a government when we outsourced torture to Syria just 7 or 8 years ago. But now it's a regime. And drawing on all of the political theatrics available in Washington, Secretary of State John Kerry gave a talk at the State Department today. He released an unclassified report after saying that he can't tell us everything that is known about chemical weapons and the allegations that they were used by the Syrian military on August 21st. Kerry said, "Read for yourselves the evidence from thousands of sources. This is the indiscriminate, inconceivable horror of chemical weapons. This is what Assad did to his own people. I think of the horror of drone strikes that we use to kill our own people, the father and son Alaki in Yemen, the innocents who've been killed in Pakistan and Afghanistan from aerial assaults, including unmanned drones by the United States, those who have died in night raids, the people who have been subject to chemical weapons that we used in the first Gulf War. It was depleted uranium. In the second Gulf War, we added the use of white phosphorus. So our hands are not at all clean, and yet we are going to force the cleansing, figuratively, of the hands of the leadership in Syria. And there's going to be a carefully targeted, maybe 2 days now, they're telling us, set of missile attacks. And who will die? Can it be so carefully targeted that only uniformed members of the Syrian military or members of the Assad leadership family or the Alawites that they are part of? No, we can't target that carefully. And if we hit the depots where we believe chemical weapons are stored, well, we open various Pandora's boxes. And then, of course, the extent to which we destabilize the Assad government eggs on the array of foreign fighters who are there pressing jihad. And this is a proxy war. We're going to discuss that in some detail in a bit. But in one case, I look at this as the proxy war that's a substitute for the attack on Iran. Or is it just a warm-up for an attack on Iran? Well, the president says, and I don't believe this, that no decision has been made. Remember when George W. Bush met with Tony Blair, January 30th of 2003? There were two things that came out of that meeting, ultimately. One was that Bush lied, and, you know, he said, I don't have any plans on my desk. Well, they were in the drawer. And we learned later that he complained to Tony Blair that there wasn't enough enthusiasm for the U.S. invasion of Iraq at that point, so maybe we ought to paint up a plane with U.N. colors and shoot it down and blame Iraq for it. That's the proposal of a false flag operation. John Kerry told us today that's not possible in Syria. The suggestion that the opposition might have been responsible is, quote, highly unlikely. He expressed high confidence in the intelligence, but didn't use the term slam dunk. I think that's copyrighted, taken out of circulation by former CIA director George Tenet. And as we discussed today with Dr. Justin Frank, the psychiatrist and author of Obama on the Couch, and you'll hear from him in a moment, all of this is based on an offhand comment, an unscripted remark from the President of the United States when he said, yeah, you know, if they use chemical weapons, that'll cross a red line. It's not a policy position. It's not something that has been hammered out in consultation with the leaders of Congress. It was a remark by the President of the United States. And I'm happy that there are rational people in the House of Commons in England, because they blocked David Cameron from becoming America's new lapdog, like Tony Blair. And what John Kerry did is, unfortunately, no different from what Dick Cheney did when he took the phony intelligence related to Curveball in the Mobile Weapons Lab, fed it to Judy Miller at the New York Times, who reliably published it, and then Cheney went on television and said, see, it's in the New York Times. And that's how you turn fiction into what passes for fact in a heated environment. So, here is the case that John Kerry laid out. He said American intelligence in the 3 days before the August 21 attack detected signs of activities by Syrian authorities associated with preparations for a chemical weapons attack. Syrian chemical weapons personnel were operating in the suburb of Adra from August 18th until early on the morning of August 21st. Now, this is all unproven information from our intelligence community, unproven in terms of independently verified. On August 21st, Syrian regime element, a Syrian regime, well, a part of their military, I hate that term regime, prepared for a chemical weapons attack, including the use of gas masks. Spy satellites detected rocket launchings from government-controlled territory 90 minutes before the first reports of a chemical weapons attack. The intelligence agency said they had identified more than 100 videos related to the attack, many showing large numbers of bodies with physical signs consistent with nerve agents, and added that the Syrian opposition doesn't have the capability to fabricate all of the videos. No mention of the point I've made of very accurate reports that the videos were uploaded a couple of hours before these events allegedly took place. The agency said they had intercepted the communications of a senior Syrian official. This is another way of showing Americans that spying is good, right? They intercepted the communications from an official who confirmed that chemical weapons were used on August 21st and was concerned with the UN inspectors obtaining evidence. Now, all the information I've just given you is reported by the New York Times from John Kerry's press conference earlier today. There is not one word from the other side, not one word from those who challenge or have skeptical views of the assertions made by Kerry, Obama, and the administration. That is what's missing here. And in a moment, I'm going to bring you the view from Syria, some very interesting reports that conflict directly with what Kerry and Obama have been telling us. We're going to talk about the media coverage, including critical comments from the New York Times public editor. And there's much more ahead. But first, I always like to thank the people who support this program through subscriptions to our podcast, and I invite you to join their ranks. I need your support to keep this work going and to pay my bills. You can take out a subscription for $5 a month, cancel anytime, get a 24-hour pass for $1 if you just want to sample the environment, or our best deal is the $50 annual subscription. With your new annual subscription, Aaron just checked in a few minutes ago with a new subscription. Thank you, Aaron. You get a bag of Kona coffee from Russ on the Big Island of Hawaii. You get a copy of Sibel Edmonds' bonus book called Classified Woman, which is more important than ever. And I believe I have one free Bradley Manning sticker left. So the first person who asks for it is going to grab that, and then they'll all be gone. Just follow the links under my picture on the homepage at peterbcollins.com where it says sign up, and you'll be all set to go. The other way you can support us is by steering your web business to GoDaddy.com. They have some of the best deals on web hosting, like this one that starts at $1.99 a month. That's web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, and you get your domain name free. To get a special deal that supports the Peter B. Collins Show, follow the GoDaddy link in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. So here comes a report from the Middle East, and I'm going to link to this story so you can see it for yourself. It is from an agency I've never heard of before called Mint Press News. Two journalists wrote this story, and they went to the town of Ghouta, G-H-O-U-T-A, in Syria. And they have followed up on allegations from interviews they conducted with residents of the area who believe that certain rebels received chemical weapons via the Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Bandar bin Sultan. Remember Bandar? Bandar Bush? He smoked cigars with W at the White House shortly after 9/11 when they were rounding up all the Saudi royal family when our airspace was closed to spirit them out of the country? Yeah, he was the ambassador to Washington at that time. So, the accusation is that chemical weapons came via Saudi Arabia and, in particular, Bandar is named. Here's a quote from the father of a rebel who's fighting against Assad, and this man lives in Ghouta. Quote, my son came to me 2 weeks ago asking if I thought the weapons were that he had been asked to carry. That's not quite computing there, but that's the way it's written. And the man, Abu Abdel Monaim, said his son and 12 other rebels were killed inside a tunnel used to store weapons provided by a Saudi militant known as Abu Ayesha, who was leading a fighting battalion. The father described the weapons as having a tube-like structure, while others were like a huge gas bottle. And Abdel Monaim said his son and others died during the chemical weapons attack. That same day, the militant group Jabhat al-Nusra, which is linked to al-Qaeda, announced that it would similarly attack civilians in the Assad government's heartland of Latakia on the western coast in purported retaliation. So, I can only report what I'm reading here. But this deserves to be fully investigated before the United States pulls the trigger on a high-risk military assault on Syria. And these reports go unmentioned in the American media and therefore are not brought to the attention of our leaders, and they're not required to comment on it. So we live in our own little media bubble in this country where truth and truthiness never quite meet. And we're getting heavy doses of truthiness right now. So I commend Margaret Sullivan, who is fairly new in the job as public editor or ombudswoman at the New York Times. And she comments online today about the New York Times coverage of Syria. She starts with a comment from a reader in Manhattan, Mark Kagan, who's very critical and says the Times has not been skeptical enough. And he writes, there's no particular reason to assume that Iraq, NSA, drones, etc., but they're embedded in the very essence of the reportage. They are the common sense within which the Times reporters operate. Past wars, past lies, just aberrations, surely, with no consequences for today's politics. So Margaret Sullivan took that up with Dean Baquet, who's the managing editor of the Times, and he's a man with a sullied reputation. He came from the Los Angeles Times, where he was the guy who took the whistleblowing information from AT&T technician Mark Klein about the NSA interception of phone calls and emails in San Francisco and turned it over to the government without publishing it in the Times. This was way back there, about 2004. That was the L.A. Times. Then Baquet went to Washington and on to New York, where he's now the managing editor. And Baquet says, nobody could read our coverage and say that the New York Times is trumpeting war. Well, I just read the article where there was not one contrary word about the rush to war in this case. So then Sullivan went to talk to Andrew Rosenthal, who runs the editorial page at the Times. And he responded differently from Baquet. He said, yes, the specter of Iraq hangs over us. I'm paraphrasing. Absolutely, no question. And then Sullivan offers her own view. Quote, here's my take. I've been observing the Times Syria coverage and its editorials for many weeks with an eye to this question. While the Times has offered deep and rich coverage from both Washington and the Syrian region, the tone cannot be described as consistently skeptical. That's an understatement. She goes on, I've noticed in recent weeks the ways that other major newspapers have signaled to their readers that they mean to question the government's assertions. And then she gives an example. She cites an item from Friday's New York Times lead story, and I'll just read part of the quote to you, punish the government of President Assad for apparently launching a deadly chemical weapons attack last week that killed hundreds. She writes, with the use of the word apparently, rather than directly attributing the administration, the Times seems to take the government's position at face value. It's a tiny example, of course, but in the aggregate, it's the kind of thing the readers I've quoted here are frustrated with. When the Times news coverage does take a more distanced approach, it does so extremely well, she says. And on the opinion side, she says that the editorials have been appropriately cautious. Well, I think she has to tread lightly in criticizing her own newspaper on its website, which could be hacked by the Syrian Electronic Army at any moment. But those are still some pretty strong comments. The Times also, in an article written by Michael Gordon, who was Judith Miller's cohort in the curveball stories back there in 2002-2003, well, he writes a piece citing the president of the Center for a New American Security, which he describes as a centrist research center, Richard Fontaine. Quote, the kind of attack the administration appears to be planning will demonstrate to Syria and to others that there's a cost the U.S. is willing to impose for crossing clearly established American red lines and violating widely held international norms. And then he added in a more honest way, but it probably will do very little to alter the fundamental balance of forces on the ground or hasten the end of the conflict. All right? So what is the purpose, Mr. President? Why are you pulling the trigger in the tinderbox of the Middle East to kill more people, and you're hoping they're going to be men in uniform of the Syrian army, in a volatile situation where the other side is an array of jihadists and foreign fighters and mercenaries, some of whom we're paying for, probably. And as we'll get to in a moment, one commentator says we're ready to join the losing side of this conflict. So I put in a crisis call to my psychiatrist, Dr. Justin Frank in Washington, D.C., and he responded to my urgent call. We spoke earlier today, and here's an excerpt from our interview, which is available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. The author of Obama on the Couch talks about why he thinks, despite the lack of support from the UN, from Britain, the wobbling of France, and the clear opposition of most Americans, the president wants to move forward with this strike.
Why he's doing this in Syria now was your original question, so let's get to that. The question, I think, has to do not so much with Dick Cheney and not so much with Netanyahu. There's something about proving that he's a man, very much so. But there's also something about, to me, it's compensating for something else, which is his inability to stand up to Congress. I really think it's a displacement of his frustration and rage with his impotence in being able to deal with John Boehner and Mitch McConnell that we've been talking about ad nauseum.
This is a very interesting line of thinking
like
here.
A displacement, you know, how, you know, you kick the person who, if the father comes home and kicks the kid, and then the kid kicks the dog. It's that kind of thing.
Well, and legally, constitutionally, he does have the latitude to launch this assault with minimal consultation and no particular approval from Congress. And
right.
So it really is the one area where he is unconstrained and doesn't
That's
have
right.
to ask Boehner and McConnell for permission.
That's right. But it's also something else with relation to Boehner McConnell. It's both the idea about a displacement of his rage and frustration, but it's also a statement that he hopes. I think there's something very screwed up about this, which is, and this may be completely off the wall for me to say, but I think there's a part of him that wants to be on their good side still, no matter what. And he feels that they're tough on foreign policy, that McCain is tough on foreign policy, that all these guys see him as being weak in foreign policy, which he's not. And he's like almost proving himself to them. I think you're right about Cheney, but I think it's much more immediate. And it's proving himself with the idea that maybe they'll go along with some of his domestic plans. I mean, why don't we sacrifice a few Syrians to go along with Obama's domestic agenda?
Well,
get Republicans to like him. I mean, it's really, it's just, it sends us into this very dark hole of confusing messages.
I invite you to listen to all the comments from Dr. Justin Frank in the interview released today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And toward the end, we talk about arrogance and hubris. And while Obama is so different from Bush, doesn't have the swagger, doesn't engage in all that dumb shit stuff, still, he's exhibiting a very different but equally dangerous kind of arrogance that we saw propel us into Afghanistan and Iraq. And while we're nominally out of Iraq, we're still stuck in Afghanistan. The Times also reports an important issue today, and that is what I referenced a moment ago, the tinderbox of the Middle East. Things are very shaky right now. And the ripple effect, the unintended consequences of this American unilateral action, is hard to predict. But just one example, Dateline Cairo. The degree of participation and violence at the protest expected today, Friday, in Cairo, will be a pivotal test of the effectiveness of the new government, that's the generals who conducted the coup. Now the expectation of American-led airstrikes against Syria has added a new variable. The prospect of a Western military action in the region is overwhelmingly unpopular here across the political spectrum, even if it is to punish Assad's government for the use of chemical weapons. If the strikes occur, they could swell the street protests, albeit from the other side. At the moment, the loudest outcry against the threat of Western strikes has not come from the Islamists, but from groups that supported Mohammed Morsi, that's the Muslim Brotherhood. And so we really struggle. And if you listen to psychiatrist Dr. Frank, it is very hard to come up with clear, rational reasons. Even if you believe in war, and even if you believe that America should be the policeman of the world. And then we have to look at stories like this. The Financial Times reports today that a company called Genie Energy has just obtained exclusive rights to a 153-square-mile radius to drill for oil in the southern part of the Golan Heights. This is the disputed territory seized by Israel during the Six-Day War in 1967 and annexed in 1981. And guess who is an advisor to Genie Energy, which is listed on the New York Stock Exchange? Former Vice President Dick Cheney, and shareholders including Jacob Rothschild and Rupert Murdoch. Now let's put aside all kinds of stuff here, like just how greedy Dick Cheney is, and how after all the money he made on Halliburton, that he's back at the trough, trying to capitalize on the chits that he laid out while he was running the Bush administration. And it buttresses the argument that America's aggression is about oil, that this is a payoff for delivering foreign policies that were either requested or demanded by Israel. And no good can come from this. Cheney will make a few million bucks, but the price in the perception of this cannot be calculated. And forgive me if you were hoping for my usual cross-section of about 10 different stories that I pluck from the news that I think are all important today. I'm only focused on this one issue of this very dangerous, misguided effort that is building. And the trigger may be pulled as early as Saturday or Sunday. That's when the UN inspectors are going to clear Damascus. They may even leave on Friday night. And this would fit into a lot of different equations because by acting this quickly, Obama will escape any effort by Congress to block it. As you know, those guys and gals aren't coming back from vacation. Nah, not to stop a war. So today I'd like to close by reading some lengthy excerpts here from a column that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle today. I've known John Carroll for over 30 years. He's a bright, incisive guy, and he carries on the great tradition of the San Francisco Chronicle as a place for creative columnists. And he writes 4 days a week on a range of topics. When he writes about his kitty cats, I skip it. But today is one of the best columns he's written in quite a while. And it goes like this. Oh, it's such a bad idea. More foreign blood on American hands. Not good. Interfering in the affairs of the nations of the Middle East? It has not worked so well for us previously as our fraught relationship with Israel demonstrates. Getting sucked into another foreign war? Boy, you would have thought that we'd learned that lesson. Of course, Obama pledges that there will be no American boots on the ground. That may even be true. But is it really moral to rain terror from above for a cause that Americans don't support enough to fight for personally? It's America as the blind assassin, taking out people from the clouds or with drones from thousands of miles away. Remember when Hillary Clinton and many other professional thinkers assured us that the Assad regime was just a shell of its former self, unable to hold out very long against the will of the people? That was 2 years ago. For a regime on its last legs, it's doing pretty well. Indeed, experts say that over the last 2 months, it's been kind of winning. So our plan is to enter that battle on the losing side. And what a side it is. Jihadists from all over the region hoping to turn Syria into the next anti-American state ruled by Sharia law. These are our friends, dear readers. We like them because they're not allied with Iran. And the balance of power, truth is, no one really knows how it will shake out. Whatever way, we'll have more enemies than when we started. Those rebels can be an ungrateful lot. We are on a perpetual war footing. We have the biggest military in the history of militaries. When you have a large military, it can grow restive. It can agitate for something to do. But all it can do is fight wars and kill people. We need protection, but we don't need these proxy wars. A war in Syria would be a proxy war, make no mistake. The issue is Iran's sway in the area. So that's what we'd be fighting about, preventing the spread of that Iranian hegemony. People forget that we've been at a proxy war with Iran for a very long time. We even helped Saddam Hussein when he was gassing Iranians. It's all the same battle, only the cannon fodder changes. When you have a large military, every problem looks like a military problem. Every problem must have a military solution. It makes us blind to the other possibilities. Russia is not blind to the other possibilities. I hate to say that. I hate to say that I like Russia's stance on Syria, peace talks rather than armed intervention, better than I like our own governments. But there you are. There's a humanitarian reason for intervening in Syria. 100,000 people have been killed, and someone must intervene to end this suffering. But if the only way we can think of to end the suffering is to cause more suffering, maybe we should sit out this round. The argument that President Obama is using to justify the attacks is that Assad used chemical weapons. It doesn't make sense. Not a lot of sense in this instance. Why would Syria risk foreign intervention into a war it's currently winning and then just do it once? But suppose it happened. How do chemical weapons change the equation? Surely the people killed by conventional weapons suffer just as much as the people killed by chemical weapons. A death is a death, a soul is a soul. The potential for mass suffering from chemical weapons remains great, I agree. But why are we in charge of enforcing the Geneva Conventions? And his closing comment, John Carroll? See Joe Biden on television defending the idea of airstrikes? Think Dick Cheney. We have always had good reason to distrust the government. Now that we may be entering another warlike conflict, the time for skepticism is right. And right this minute. That is John Carroll of the San Francisco Chronicle. I'll link to that column so you can read it for yourself. It'll be in the show file at peterbcollins.com. I plan to take Monday off, but if events warrant, I'll come in on the holiday and lay out a podcast for you. Otherwise, be back at you Tuesday on most of these same internet stations. This is the podcast you're invited to share far and wide. And I thank you for listening. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.